Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Chinese President Xi Jinping and U.S. President Joe Biden say they had a candid and constructive phone conversation. NATO foreign ministers gather in Brussels to discuss more aid for Ukraine as the bloc prepares to mark its 75th anniversary. A UN spokesperson stresses safety of humanitarian workers in Gaza after seven staff members of an international food charity were killed in an Israeli airstrike. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. The leaders of China and the United States say they had a candid and constructive phone conversation and agreed to maintain communication. Chinese President Xi Jinping stressed the importance of exchanges, respect, and cooperation. He highlighted peace and trust for developing bilateral ties. President Xi Jinping also reiterated China's positions on the Taiwan question and U.S. sanctions on Chinese enterprises. U.S. President Joe Biden reaffirmed his counterpart of Washington's commitment of the One China principle and pledged not to decouple. Lu Wei has more.
President Xi told his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden that China-U.S. ties are stabilizing. As officials from both sides act on leaders' agreements reached at their San Francisco meeting last November, President Xi underscored three overarching principles of China-U.S. ties. First, peace must be valued. The two sides should emphasize no conflict and no confrontation. Second, stability must be prioritized. The two countries should refrain from provoking incidents or crossing red lines. Third, credibility must be upheld. China and the U.S. should honor their commitments to each other with action and turn the San Francisco vision into reality. On the Taiwan question, Xi Jinping made it clear that China will not sit on its hands in the face of Taiwan independence separatist activities or of any external encouragement and support for it. He called on Washington to act on President Biden's commitment of not supporting Taiwan independence. On U.S. sanctions, President Xi noted a strain of measures adopted by the U.S. to suppress China's trade and technology development and its addition of more Chinese entities to its sanction lists. The president warned that this was not de-risking, but creating risks. He said the U.S. will always find China's door open when it seeks mutually beneficial cooperation. But China will never remain silent on any U.S. moves to deprive China of its legitimate rights to development. President Joe Biden reiterated that the United States does not seek a new Cold War or conflict with China, nor does it seek to change China's system. The U.S. also does not support Taiwan independence.
That was Lu Wei with a report. Now for more, we're joined by Anna Tangen, Senior Fellow at the Taihe Institute, also Zha Daojiong, Professor of International Political Economy at the School of International Studies at Peking University. Thank you, Anna, and thank you, Professor Zha, for joining me. Let me start with Anna, please. Overall, how do you observe the tone of the remarks by the two leaders?
All in all, it was fairly cordial. It was more like a laundry list. They were more concerned about covering all the areas that seemed to be of concern to both sides. Obviously, Biden, who is looking for its election, sees this in terms of domestic politics. And I think the timing is very clearly has something to do with Janet Yellen, who is going to be visiting Beijing and pressing her point.
Okay. Professor Zha, what about you?
Well, it's interesting that this is taking place partly because here in China, after the two sessions, it's a new beginning cycle of politics, of policymaking for the year. On the U.S. side, along with Easter and also the nomination of both Biden and Trump for their respective political parties, it's about time to compare notes, and I would think neither side is quote-unquote having a better position because on the U.S. side, Biden actually is in competition with at least two other streams of politics, and each of the three, each of the other two is quite powerful. One is Trump, one is Congress. And so he has to, you know, show Biden as the president, as the legal representative of America, he has to show that, quote-unquote, he's in charge. And that's not easy. And on the Chinese side as well, you know, the economy, no matter what we say about principles, we're against decoupling, but nevertheless, economic recoveries are difficult. That's not always due to foreign forces. If we look at the heavy burden of the real estate sector, no foreign government would help us. So, yeah, I think it's useful. The conversation is useful, and there's some unique domestic political context
going
to happen.
Well, let's take a look at, in specifics, some of the remarks. So Xi Jinping noted since the San Francisco meeting between himself and Biden, while bilateral relations have begun to stabilize, the negative factors of the relationship have also been growing. Aina, in your observation, what are these negative factors that have grown?
Well, obviously, the visits to Taiwan, the increased militarization through sending weapons there, creating more alliances against China, and talking about not only Taiwan but the South China Seas. Then you have the obviously this small yard high fences thing, which is unfortunately growing to be a very big fence. It's now expanded into anything to do with finance as well as technology. You see the attacks on TikTok, the naming of more and more companies associated with Huawei onto blacklists, including individuals, a very belligerent tone by Congress itself, saying that they want to, clamp down on China, and it's bipartisan. So while the U.S. Says all the right words, I think Xi was very correct in saying that words and actions have to be the same. You can't just say things and do something else.
Now, Professor Zhao, do you have more to add?
Well, I think just to continue what I said about that U.S. administration in competition with a shadowy president and a very hostile Congress. But then each of the three subscribe to this notion of differentiating among the Chinese Communist Party, the party, the military, and the people. Whereas this is really the root of what, here in China we say, we see as the words not matching deeds. And the root of that is that any political force in the U.S. can say, well, I'm doing so, that's hurting the Chinese people, that's hurting the Chinese economy, but my aim is the party, my aim is the military. So, in other words, we can keep talking about trust building, but the whole template for the U.S. political forces to operate is impossible because they're in competition with each other. They always have some convenient excuse because they divide China into conceptually into the those three categories. I'm most stressed by the expansion of this so-called yard of fence, biotech. This is inhumane. U.S. military folks, soldiers, whatnot, take medicine. This is just, it's beyond comprehension. What exactly are these guys trying to do when you try to, suppress a fairly competitive Chinese company that's producing pharmaceutical materials? No, I'm not joking. And it's going to lose, when you start to have people who do these things by saying, well, it's about the party. It's about the military, not about the medicine. Oh, gosh.
So
it's that kind of madness. So in other words, I'm not trying to be skeptical. I'm not trying to be negative. Sometimes I do feel, oh, yes, another conversation. Oh, yes, another summit.
Mm.
But if the fundamentals don't get rethought a little bit.
Mm.
And on our side, of course, there are also, if we hear Americans who talk about our side, we also will have to rethink some of our approaches. But mm. I'm rather stressed out. I'm sorry.
The political debates and the political atmosphere in Washington, D.C. can get very poisonous sometimes. I think what Professor Zhao has just talked about is related to what President Xi Jinping stressed during their conversation, which is the issue of a strategic perception. So President Xi Jinping said that this issue of strategic perception is always fundamental to the China-U.S. relationship, just like the first button of a shirt that must be put right. Aina, is he indicating that there's something wrong with the strategic perception of China by Americans at the moment? What has gone wrong then?
Well, what has gone wrong is this kind of what I call American exceptionalism, this idea that regardless of what America does, it doesn't matter because it's for the greater good. It's ideological. Mm-hmm. You know, it's very hard to argue with somebody if they say, I'm right, you're wrong. How do you argue with them? How do you come to some sort of consensus? And this is kind of what China is facing. In the U.S., there's this real belief. I mean, deep down, you can talk to people in the street. They've been convinced by the government and by the media that somehow China is wrong, that 45 years of constant progress, lifting their people up, there's something wrong with it. And it's incomprehensible. I agree with Professor Zhao. I mean, why is this a bad thing? But that is the feeling. There's a sense that if China rises, this is a zero-sum game. That means America will lose. And the fact is we've already entered a multipolar reality. No country, it's not unipolar anymore. And this is something that's very, very, very difficult, especially in Washington, for them to accept. They believe that they have to be in charge of the world, otherwise it falls to pieces. Never mind the fact that they've been in charge for quite some time and the world is in pieces.
I remember what the former Chinese ambassador to United States, Cui Tiankai, mentioned something in an open forum when he said the problem for the United States is that it should be ready itself to accept a stronger China, but a China that is different from the United States. Professor Zhao, what's your thought on that? What's your thought on what Ambassador Cui Tiankai had said?
Well, I don't know. I think diplomats and the professors talk about these things in different ways. And you have varieties of professors, too. I'm just one of them. I have all the respect for our diplomats and diplomats of any other country, including the United States. But there is a problem when diplomats start to talk about foreign policy matters or talk about principles without specifying context in terms of time, a time frame, or in terms of reference to specific events. When you say to accept that China is stronger, what do you mean that U.S. does not accept? No, many Americans can rightfully say, no, wait a minute, you know, without the U.S. conducting normal trade of China, how can you have got stronger without the U.S. doing this, without you doing that? So it's that these kind of bland, and these kind of broad stroke statements can often end up, the speaker may have one intent, but for the audience, it can easily lose the audience, and because the speaker and audience are referring to different things. But back to your question, I don't think it's accurate to say that the U.S. does not accept a stronger China. But I do think the U.S. is sort of repeating a historical cycle back, in the 60s, when West Germany started to get normalized. The Americans started to feel, oh, my goodness, you know, the World War II, Germany had been defeated. It should have stayed defeated. If we look at CFIUS, that was actually created first to deal with German investment into the United States. Then by the 70s and 80s, Japan, of course, and Japan was defeated by the U.S. in World War II. So you have a repetition. It's a cycle. I don't really think, you know, as many here in China say, well, the U.S. Again, there are different stages of the U.S. sentiment. So let's put it that way, American sentiment, prevalent sentiment. Gallers of China's success. I don't think that's the singular explanation. If we here in China got so stuck with that and shift all the blame to the Americans, I don't think it would do us any good, and we will not. I doubt we would be able to win friends and the support from the rest of the world either.
Well, it's always good to reflect on one's own policies as well. But I want to get your response on what Professor Zhao has just talked about, and also on the question of whether or when, you know, the U.S. will be ready to see this strong but different China.
Okay, so I'm going to have to respectfully disagree. The U.S. embarked on the Marshall Plan, which was to build up Germany and Japan. They were trying to learn from the lessons of World War I, where reparations against Germany actually backfired and careened into World War II. But there was also another part to this. The U.S. Saw Europe as a competitor, and they knew that if they would, you know, instead of helping France and England, et cetera, they put all their money really into these defeated nations, and they rose up. But when they rose up, there's a couple of things that happened. Yes, in the 70s, Japan, all the things that are being said about China today were said about Japan, that they have an alien system, that they're not really democratic, that they've stolen IP. You had senators and congressmen standing outside taking hammers and bashing cars, Japanese cars and Toshiba boomboxes. In 1986, Japan was in essence forced to sign the Plaza Accord. And to give you some idea of the effect of that, Japan today in real dollar terms is worth less than it was in 1986.
Indeed.
So the U.S. Did that. Now, in terms of Germany, Germany's rise really bothered the U.S. because they were afraid that Germany and Russia would come together, that Russian resources, cheap oil and gas, would make Germany an unstoppable economic rival. So the U.S. does not play well with others. We never have. We had the Monroe Doctrine to keep anybody away from South America. Anytime there was any kind of issue down there, we would send in the troops to defend our economic interests. So this idea that somehow the U.S. is just kind of bumping along and trying to do the best it can, I think that's wrong. We're an aggressive nation. We've only had 7 years of complete peace when we have not been at conflict with one nation or had troops occupying another nation. So, and that's since the very beginning, the American Revolution. So America is unfortunately still in its teen years, very aggressive. We always see things as we win, you lose. That is something that is not civilizational. If you look at any civilization, it always comes down to, okay, we have different ideas, but we can coexist together as long as you don't insist that you follow mine. And this is something that takes time to do and a certain amount of maturity. Being a conqueror does not give you a civilization. And this is one thing that both Europe and the United States still have to learn.
Well, I think we're going to something very deep about perhaps the ethos of a nation, if you like. But But going back to the specifics of these, this conversation between the two presidents, I mean, just a few days ago, President Xi Jinping met members of U.S. businesses and strategic and academic communities, leaders who were here in Beijing to attend this year's China Development Forum. And in their remarks at the meeting, people like Chairman and CEO of Blackstone and President and CEO of Qualcomm, the chip company, have expressed a willingness to maintain their strong commitment in the Chinese market and pursue close and long-term cooperation with the Chinese market. Professor Zhao, how do you see the current plans of these U.S. businesses and organizations to stay committed and engaging with China?
Well, each of these major organizations have its own global value chain.
Mm.
I would think there are two, among others, two major factors behind the high level of representation and the group meeting, you know, all the major, the CEOs of major companies coming to Beijing for the forum. They don't have to, but they did.
Mm.
One is that, you know, over the past year or two, there was indeed that sort of experimentation of any country but China.
Mm-hmm.
But then the CEOs would need to factor in, you know, the technological capacity, policies in those countries, and they would test out how have the initial assessment of returns.
Mm.
After all, business is business around the world. In other words, that let's replace China isn't quite ready in some sectors.
Mm, indeed.
And now the second factor is that I think the especially when you look at the Chinese experimentation with their own economic policy, I think gradually there is that recognition, especially, you know, if I were CEO, I look at the Chinese government's decision to let some of the real estate agencies go bankrupt. This was singular policy was the most powerful signal that say, oh, okay, Chinese policies are back to truly supporting innovation rather than protecting the speculative forces that count, you know, keep piling up money after money on the same block of bricks,
mm-hmm.
the real estate. So that's a different kind of confidence to say, well, after all, the society is full of individuals, full of opportunities of innovation. Now, the micro and macroeconomic policies or the signal seems to be right, and they're back to explore. I think those are the two reasons.
Mm. Well, we have about a minute to wrap up the conversation, but Aina, what's your thought on this?
Well, I go back to Professor Zhao when he was talking about how the U.S. regards China as, you know, people, army, and government. In fact, in the U.S., we also have our separation. You have the elites, Washington, the politicians. You have business people, but they're also divided between business people who, you know, make things, consumer products, et cetera, machines, and the military-industrial complex, which profits from war. And then you have, you know, just the people. And unfortunately, for 45 years, the people have not been doing well. 62% of America 45 years ago was middle class. Today, it's 50% and falling.
Mm.
60% of the people are unhappy, although 40% are very happy. Because, you know, the top 1%, for example, has gained $2 trillion since the beginning of this year. But there's an inequality that's there. And at this point...
Yeah, I think that's... one of the reasons, you know, why people always say the two economies are so much closely linked with each other. Thank you. That was Aina Tangen from Taihe Institute and Zha Daozhong from Peking University. You're listening to World Today. We'll be right back after a short break.
Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. NATO foreign ministers are gathering this week in Brussels to discuss more aid for Ukraine as the bloc prepares to mark its 75th anniversary. Officials said at a two-day meeting on Wednesday and Thursday, ministers are expected to discuss a proposal by NATO chief Jens Stoltenberg for a $108 billion five-year fund for Ukraine. The aim is to finalize a package in time for Washington summit in July when U.S. President Joe Biden will host NATO leaders. Now, for more on this, we're joined by Kamal Makili Aliyev. He is affiliated researcher at Raoul Wallenberg Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Sweden. Thank you, Kamal. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Now, in your observation, what are some of the priority issues that will be discussed by these foreign ministers, immediate or long term?
I would say that the immediate issues would include the NATO involvement in the war in Ukraine, its external threats produced by the growing number of conflicts in the world, including the one between Israel and Palestine, including the conflicts on the African continent. And that would be the immediate goals. The longer term ones would be the state of the alliance and how much they can be developing in the way that they have been developing as an organization. What are the shortcomings of the previous years and what can be done to change the strategic course, maybe to produce more unity, because we've seen in the last years a lot of disagreements between several members of the bloc and this kind of growing tension in the alliance itself.
Mm. Well, regarding the war in Ukraine and more aid for Ukraine, over the past years, we have seen, since the war broke out, we have seen discussions, debates, and even, sometimes quarrels among NATO members regarding how much and in what ways they can help Ukraine. At this moment, what are some contentious issues among NATO members regarding the war in Ukraine now?
The most contentious issues that are, around the war in Ukraine is how much the members can continue with providing the Ukraine with financial and military resources, how much of the involvement of the single members as well as an organization is going to be topical for the next 5 years, I would say, in terms of that kind of help and how much resources the NATO can pull up from the members. It's also going to be a discussion about how much the United States is going to be helpful on that front, because we've seen that there is a hesitation by the Congress in the United States to approve additional aid for Ukraine, as well as the questions about more immediate concerns, unifying the political will around the NATO states and into something more coherent, because we've seen the statements by the Emmanuel Macron, president of France, for example, that didn't sit so well with other members of the European Union or the NATO alliance. So those kind of issues are going to be discussed in relation to the Ukraine and opposition from certain states in NATO, for example, such as Hungary, to the provision of more aid, etc., etc. Those are the topical issues.
Mm. Well, then Kamal, on that, how do you see the possibility of this proposal by Stoltenberg? A $108 billion five-year fund. That's a very long time for Ukraine. How do you see the possibility of that?
I see this as a possibility that is right now on the level of suggestion of the project, because for now there is no concrete commitment of the NATO to that, actually. So it is something that the Stoltenberg have began, but he is an outgoing leader of the alliance. So there might be a question of what the new leadership is going to be doing, if it's going to be continuing the same track. But as of now, it's very hard and very early to say that there is a consensus about going forward with this project. It's definitely going to be something discussed right now by the NATO in this meeting. Yeah.
Okay. Now about Jens Stoltenberg, the Wall Street Journal reports that at this meeting, NATO foreign ministers will want to agree on the selection of the next Secretary General because Stoltenberg is leaving by the end of September. How big is an issue? Is the issue of the selection of the next leader for the bloc? And who are the front runners now?
Oh, the issue is big because we are now seeing that it's quite one of the most contentious races for this position because the two previous contenders have dropped off, the UK Defence Secretary Ben Wallace and the Danish Prime Minister, the previous Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen. They have both retracted their interest, and I think that's because of the position of the United States. But they're also right now, the front runners are, if I'm not mistaken, Estonian Prime Minister Kaja Kallas.
Right.
There is Latvian Foreign Minister Kristianis Karins, and the former Dutch Prime Minister Mark Rutte. Yeah, Mark Rutte. Those are the three front runners, and Mark Rutte is the favorite by unofficial and more official channels. It seems like there is a consensus building around him, but the decision have not been made yet. And so this meeting is going to be central for that candidacy to solidify. Mm. But a lot of people are convinced that Rutte might be just the next Secretary General of NATO. Yeah.
Mm. But Kamal, let's be realistic. Decisions of NATO will eventually be made in capitals of different member states. So what is really the significance of a leader for the bloc, of the Secretary General?
Well, the leader of the bloc actually establishes the strategic agenda to where the bloc is going to go. Of course, the most important decisions are going to be political decisions taken, as you say, in the capitals, but in consensus when it comes to the NATO membership. On the other side, the Secretary General also is the one who publicly discusses the NATO policy and is the most strongest political figure in the NATO. It's representative, basically, even with that consensus. So that consensus is also going to be communicated through the future leader of NATO. So it's quite a strong position. Plus, that person is also very much consulted when it comes to the organizational part of the alliance.
Mm-hmm.
And the NATO capitals are going to be listening to the advice from that person.
Okay. Now, Kamal, NATO now has 75 years of history. U.S. President Joe Biden in July will host a summit of all NATO leaders in D.C., where the founding treaty was signed. But judging from the domestic, political atmosphere of the United States at the moment, will the United States continue to lead the bloc?
It's right now not quite clear because at some point we see that there is a lot of more agency right now in the European states. It have been a process that has been going on inside the alliance for a very long time. But the latest indicators of that is sometimes inability for the administration, current administration in the United States and other NATO capitals to come to a consensus amongst several issues. One of the dividing issues is also, of course, the aid to Ukraine, etc. But there's also a prognostications that United States might be pulling out a little bit from the NATO cooperation to a certain degree if there is a change in the administration in the United States. So that speculation is also there. But it remains to be seen of where this leadership role of the United States is going to go. Because this year is going to be crucial in that sense, because if there is a change of administration in the United States, there is a high possibility of more isolationist policy of new administration. Mm-hmm. And that would mean, of course, impact on NATO.
Right. So a lot of issues are waiting for these foreign ministers of NATO in Brussels. Thank you, Kamal. We appreciate your time and insight. That was Kamal Makili Aliyev, affiliated researcher at Raoul Wallenberg Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Sweden. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
as one of CGTN Radio's most popular programs, World Today provides listeners with a strong mix of international news and business. It delivers in-depth analysis of current affairs and one-on-one interviews, bringing you the stories behind the news, not just what's happening, but why.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The spokesperson for the UN chief says humanitarian workers in Gaza must be ensured of their safety while doing their jobs. Stefan Dujarric made the remarks after seven staff members of international food charity World Central Kitchen had been killed in an Israeli airstrike when they were on a humanitarian mission. The spokesperson says the UN has once again called for an immediate ceasefire in the 6-month-long conflict between Israel and Palestine.
We have a deconfliction mechanism, which clearly, I mean, for our part, we have noted that it was not working properly. We keep delivering aid, as we said, on an opportunistic basis, which is no way to run a major aid operation. And this is why the Secretary General and all of us, all of the senior leaders of the UN continue to push for a humanitarian ceasefire so we can deliver aid in safety, not only for our own colleagues, but especially for those who are meant to receive the aid.
The attack has been condemned by many UN officials as well as by the governments of the United States, the UK, Australia, and many Middle Eastern countries. Israel has assumed responsibility for the attack, vowing to conduct a thorough investigation. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says the airstrike was unintended and that they will do everything to prevent a recurrence. For more on this, I earlier talked to Zhang Chuchu, Associate Professor and Deputy Director, Center for Middle Eastern Studies at Fudan University. Now, Herzi Halevi, who is the Chief of Staff of Israel's Armed Forces, said several airstrikes on an aid convoy operated by this World Central Kitchen, which killed 7-8 workers, were a grave mistake. He said it resulted from a misidentification of the vehicles in the 8 convoy in complex conditions at night. What do you make of his words?
Well, it may be an accident, but what has actually happened depends on the subsequent investigation results. But in any case, I think this is a very sad story because you know that the World Central Kitchen, they did nothing wrong and all the actions follow the international law. Their members, they come from all over the world, and now they know the situation is already very bad, and it has already been very difficult to provide aid to the Gaza Strip, as you know that there are a lot of limitations, and also the transportation is very difficult. And when the aid convoy is attacked, it means that fewer people and groups are motivated to provide aid, and also the attack is also going to further deteriorate the humanitarian crisis in the Gaza Strip. And I think that is what exactly the international community is worried about.
Mm. Now, taking a look at the overall picture, tell us what aid Gaza refugees need the most at the moment.
Right. Well, the Gaza people, they are already in a very difficult condition at the moment because they cannot live normal life. So first of all, like a lot of people, they are living in very limited space and lots of critical supplies are lacking. And I think right now they are urgently in need of critical supplies like food, water, and electricity. And also, if you look at the statistics and the reports, there are already the danger of facing famine in the place. And on the other hand, there are also very few medical centers there because actually during the war, some hospitals have already been badly damaged. And we often find news reporting that medicines and anesthetics are not enough. So right now, I think it is particularly dangerous for women and children, and there is a high risk for baby delivery. So Gaza is desperately in need of relevant medical supplies.
Mm. Now, which groups or societies have been actively working in the region to help the refugees?
Well, yes, actually, a lot of international organizations are trying to offer some kind of help and aid. For instance, there are a lot of United Nations organizations. In fact, And there are a total of more than 20 United Nations agencies in the place. And right now, I think a lot of them are trying to reach out. For instance, there's the UNICEF, and also there are like UNESCO, there are like United Nations and Development Program, etc. So all those like United Nations organizations are working there. And also there are a lot of regional non-government organizations, for instance, the regional ones from the other like Arab states, for instance. But at the same time, we also need to note that there is a huge difficulty for these kind of organizations to work. For instance, there is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees in the Near East, which is a very famous one. And it provides a lot of aid to the region. But now it faces huge difficulties because Israel claims that this organization provides sort of support for Hamas. And it proposes the dissolution of this organization, and a lot of its members are facing huge difficulties to provide aid at the moment. So I would say right now it's becoming more and more difficult for the aid group.
Well, U.S. President Joe Biden has issued a blunt criticism on Israel and said an incident like this should not happen. Other countries like Australia issued similar responses too. How big an impact do you think such international pressure will make on Israel's decision-making?
Well, actually, this is a very important question. And I think if we look at the issue from a bigger picture, then it is a very interesting note that in the United States, attitude is very interesting and very tricky. Because on the one hand, Joe Biden has criticized Israel, but on the other hand, he has also increased the aid to Israel, especially after Israel attacked the Iranian embassy in Syria. And I think one of the intentions for Israel to do so is to expand the war and bring Iran to the battlefield, because it knows that Iran is an enemy that the United States cares a lot about. So by attacking Iranian embassy and its other equipment, it tries to send a signal to Washington by saying, hey, we are not just fighting Hamas, but actually we are also acting against Iran and Shia partners in the region for your sake. So, you know, it's not just for us, but it's also for you. So you're going to give us more support. And no matter what Biden says, you see that he did give Israel more support. So I say that actually Netanyahu has achieved this goal, so I don't think Israel will indeed feel much pressure from the United States.
Well, demonstrations have been held in Israel over the past few days demanding the Israeli government to put more efforts on hostage releasing and early elections in the country. Will these demonstrations influence Israel's moves in its fight against Hamas?
I would say that the impact is very limited. Well, actually, it is not the first time that Netanyahu faces criticism. And right now, he himself is not in an easy situation because you see domestically, many Israelis accuse him of being ineffective in rescuing hostages. And also, we have seen that the center and left party strongly opposes his rule. And also internationally, he faces a lot of pressure and criticism from the international community. So right now, he himself strives to adopt the hardline position in order to unite and enhance his hardline support base. So from my own observation and analysis, I think he knows that it's very hard to break the current deadlock in negotiations due to the fundamental disagreements between Hamas and Israel. So he urgently needs to achieve some sort of results on the battlefield to show his achievements.
Zhang Chuchu, Associate Professor and Deputy Director, Center for Middle Eastern Studies, Fudan University. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, I am Dr. Digby James Wren, a political analyst and international relations scholar specializing in China area studies. World Today offers unmatched in-depth perspectives on China's politics, economics, business, technology, and society. World Today's team of reporters and contributors provides valuable information from all of the world's major economies. I hope you can join me on World Today for the very best insights and news from China, on China, and help to build a better understanding of China's role in the world today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Taylor Swift has become the first person to join Forbes billionaires list based only on earnings from her music and performances. According to Forbes, Swift's fortune includes over $500 million in estimated wealth amassed from royalties and touring, plus a music catalog worth $500 million and $125 million in real estate. Swift's record-breaking Eras Tour, which kicked off in March last year, became the first tour in history to earn more than $1 billion. Her U.S. concerts added an estimated $4.3 billion to the country's gross domestic product in 2023. Now, for more on this, Zhao Ying joins us in the studio. Thank you, Zhao Ying.
Thank you.
Now, how significant is this milestone?
Well, I believe it's a major achievement for any musician, because traditionally building immense wealth within the music industry has been challenging. But Taylor Swift's feats demonstrate the immense earning potential for artists who not only create hit music, but also have a strong hand in managing their careers, touring extensively, and building a global fan base. And notably, Taylor Swift is ranked number 14 on the celebrity list, but she is the first billionaire solely off earnings from the music and touring. There are other stars on the list who made significant portions of their bankroll from other investment, like number 9, Rihanna's $1.4 billion net worth, much from her Fenty Beauty brand. And number 9, Jay-Z's holdings in his champagne brand contributed significantly to his $2.4 billion net worth. But Taylor Swift is the first on this list who built wealth only through her talent in music. And this also reflects a potential shift in power dynamics within the music industry, because traditionally record labels held much of the financial leverage, but Swift's success, which was built heavily on touring and merchandise sales, suggests that artists can achieve financial independence and significant wealth creation through direct fan engagement.
Well, that's quite remarkable. So the Eras Tour seems to have had a profound economic impact, not just in terms of ticket, but also on local businesses and even entire cities. So can you explain more on how this tour has become a game changer in this regard?
Yes, indeed. The Eras Tour has become a phenomenon that transcends music. Apart from ticket sales, Swifties are known for their dedication, and they spend heavily on outfits, merchandise, travel, and even collector's items like vinyl records. And this creates a massive boost for local businesses. And cities hosting Swift sees a surge in tourism and revenue. For instance, Chicago's tourism industry revived after her 3-night stand, and that generated more revenue than the Super Bowl held there earlier. And hotels, restaurants, and transportation all benefit from the influx of fans. It is estimated that Swift's Eras Tour brought in nearly $6 billion to the U.S. economy in 2023, and it is no exaggeration to say that Taylor Swift is an American economic engine. But this isn't just a U.S. story, because world leaders are vying to get Swift to tour their countries as well, like the president of Chile, the mayor of Budapest, and Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau have all requested a concert in their areas, and this is called Swiftnomics. And also, it's worth noting that this enthusiasm comes despite broader economic challenges, because, you know, even though there's a cost of living crisis in many places, people are still forking out thousands of dollars to see Taylor Swift. And a U.S. study of concert goers shows that even with an average of more than $1,300 spent per event, 91% say they would go again.
That's quite inspirational. So what factors have contributed to the Eras Tour's success?
Well, there are many factors. First of all, with a career spanning 17 years, Swift has a vast collection of hits. And the Eras Tour allows fans to revisit all her musician eras, and that's a powerful nostalgia factor. And Swift's connection with her fans is also legendary. She writes her own music, she has re-recorded albums to regain control of her work, and she actively engages with her audience. And this fan connection also contributed to her success. And also the timing is very important because the tour caters to the pent-up demand for live events after the pandemic. And people are eager for immersive experience and social connections, and the concert creates a great opportunity.
Well, Zhang Ying, Singapore reportedly invested millions to secure Taylor Swift's concert as part of their quote-unquote concert economics strategy. So did this approach pay off in terms of boosting tourism and the local economy?
Well, the strategy seems to be a huge success because, you know, Singapore is the only country to host Swift's all six shows in Asia. Mm. So many fans travel to the concert from other countries. And Singapore's currency is one of the strongest in Asia. And this has long been a deterrent for visitors. But for a chance to see their idol, many of the fans are willing to grin and bear it. And the Singapore government also benefits from a 9% tax on tourist spending across hotels, food, and other services. But, you know, some economists suggest that although getting exclusive access to Swift was a smart short-term move by the Singapore government, it might not be a long-term solution because, after all, Swifties' ultimate goal is to enjoy the show, not to incur high travel costs amid a weakening global economy. So while it provided a temporary influx of cash for Singapore, they ultimately won't make a lasting difference, perhaps.
Well, briefly, Zhao Ying, how do you see this trend of concert economics evolve in the future?
Well, I think maybe we'll see more competition between cities and countries vying for major tours. And actually, Singapore's move has triggered some criticism from neighboring countries. Like the Prime Minister of Thailand accused Singapore of paying concert organizers $2 to $3 million per night. Mm. And he said if he had known this, he would have splashed more money to attract Taylor Swift's performance. Mm. So I guess maybe in the future, this huge investment will become the norm, leading to bidding wars and drive up the cost of securing top artists. Mm. But also, I think they may look for some more sustainable approach.
Right.
I think perhaps nations can promote local musicians and open a gateway for outsiders to learn about their own culture. And this will create a long-term competitive advantage.
Mm. Well, such an interesting topic. Thank you, Zhao Ying. That's all the time we have for this edition of World Today. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, download our podcast by searching World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.